Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Dr. Dudley Danoff, MD, who is a world-renowned urologist, is my guest for the eighth time, number eight, on Love, Lust, and Laughter. And he is the author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, formerly called Penis Power, got renamed. Hello, Dr. Danoff.
Hi,
it is so
Diana.
Good to have you
so
back
nice
again.
To be with you again.
Thank you. How come you had to change the title?
Well, I you know, it's not really that I had to. We had some offers from the Foreign Press, and basically they wanted us to make the original book 100 pages shorter. So we did that, and we updated it with some new and fresh medical information, but basically the same shtick from the old book.
Right.
And, you know, we had gotten a lot of pushback from the mainstream press about the word penis on the cover, penis power, and I'd have to start every interview by saying, you know, penis is not a pejorative word. Penis is a body part. The penis is to the urologist what the stomach is to the gastroenterologist. Get over it.
Exactly.
And I, you know, I got tired of saying that, so I said, well, we might as well bring it a little bit more to the center, so we called it The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, and we took that funny logo on the front where we took the eye, I mean, the end of the word penis and the eye of the... and we sort of made it into something that looked like male genitalia. I mean, nothing obscene. You know, we're in the 21st century. We have Howard Stern. We have the Internet. You know, grow up, America. Hello.
Hello. I think that's why you've been a frequent guest on this program. And, of course, the media is a great way to get out good, solid information. I'm very grateful to Progressive Radio Network because this is the sixth year, number six, that this program has been aired. And, people need to get your book. They need to listen to this program. And, of course, for this show, we're going to look at two common male problems, the most common for the male client patients that I see, and that would be PE, or premature ejaculation, and ED, erectile dysfunction. So let's start with PE, and you have a very good definition for premature ejaculation in your book. You have several definitions, but would you review those?
Well, I mean, premature ejaculation means that the male is unable to complete intercourse either to his partner's satisfaction or to his own, and, you know, he finishes basically before he started. So it's a fairly loose definition. It's extremely common in younger men, often associated with performance anxiety. It's very, very common in middle-age or older populations who have very infrequent sex. So those are the two primary categories of men with premature ejaculation. So one of the cures, certainly in the younger patient, is have more sex, meaning that the more times you ejaculate, the longer the refractory period, that is, the time it takes from one ejaculation to the next. Now, as men get older, that is one of the great advantages of getting older, because our refractory period, secondary to age, increases. So I often say, you know, it takes me all night long to do what I used to do all night long.
Exactly. This is really important for younger men and older men to know.
Right.
And there really are so many solutions for this. You write in your book, Surprisingly, less than 20% of men with premature ejaculation seek treatment. So it's a hidden problem for many. What is your experience of this in terms of your patients?
They do rarely seek treatment, and there is good, there are good treatment options. So there's a couple of things that I recommend that are quite simple to do. There's a over-the-counter spray, which is called Promescent. I believe it's spelled P-R-O-M-E-S-C-E-N-T. It's basically a lidocaine jelly spray, an anesthetic spray that you spray on the head of the penis, the glands. That's very effective. And then, of course, we have the SSRI group, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Paxil is the most common, Zoloft. So they are mostly taken for panic disorders or social anxiety or generalized anxiety or a post-traumatic stress disorder. But for premature ejaculation, we take advantage of the side effect of those medicines, which is to retard ejaculation. And the dose, for example, in Paxil is 10 milligrams, which is a low dose. You take it for 2 weeks as a, quote, loading dose, and then the 10 milligrams on demand. And you could do the same with Zoloft, the dosage being 25 milligrams. Again, 2 weeks loading dose and then on demand. And I guess as a side effect, you can allay your anxiety.
Yes, because anxiety is such a huge part of premature ejaculation. But these Paxil and Zoloft, I know firsthand, I work with a naturopath and also a urologist, and these can really help delay ejaculation in the right amount, and taken often just before intercourse.
Yeah, we usually recommend a loading dose and then taken about an hour before. And, you know, if you look on the package insert for either Paxil or Zoloft, I mean, if you're taking it because you have an anxiety disorder, one of the side effects is that you can expect delay in ejaculation. So now we've taken that adverse side effect and we're using it in terms of premature ejaculation to our advantage.
Yes, yes. And, of course, the doses that you prescribe for PE are lower than those used for depression.
Oh, yeah, much lower than for anxiety disorder, yes. Perhaps a half to a third the dose.
Uh-huh. And then there are sometimes other side effects, as I understand it, such as dry mouth and sometimes nausea.
Because we're taking a lower dose, those are usually not problematic.
Right, right.
And then, of course, something sexual therapy, which is probably more in your area of expertise, there are many, many, many exercises, and I do outline a few of them in my book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. And if you go to my website, theultimateguidetomalehealth.com, you'll see these suggestions. But, you know, practicing with your partner, being stimulated to almost the point of no return, and then stopping and then doing a few maneuvers that I describe in the book, and then starting it all over again, those are good exercises to prolong inevitable. I mean, when you get sexually excited, there is a point of inevitability where there's no turning back because to ejaculate is actually a reflex. Once you pass that threshold of inevitability, it's out of your hands. So the idea is to get to that threshold and then do something to sort of calm things down and start again from square one.
Yeah, you described it very well in your book, and I think that people with more knowledge really do better there was a small survey of sex therapists because people wonder, well, do sex therapists have better sex? And it turns out we do, because we have less anxiety, more knowledge, more confidence, and so on. And that really makes a difference. And
well,
again, that's why I like...
I mean, I think being a sex therapist or being a urologist is like being, you know, an expert at building a bridge. I mean, knowledge is power. So
things that
happen to a knowledgeable person become understandable, and things that happen to someone who is not conversant, you know, in all the variables of human interaction become a mystery and very difficult to solve, and often, you know, become this self-fulfilling prophecy. So, yeah, I mean, I'm all for the more you know about how and why and where it works, the better equipped you are to enjoy, you know, sexual health, great sexual health.
Great sexual health. I often, if a guy has not seen his doctor, his urologist, his general practitioner, better the urologist, the specialist, I suggest get checked, because PE can always be treated, and some men just need help coping with anxiety, and they may come to me for that, and they may also have unrealistic expectations. But there can be other problems, like hormonal imbalance, right?
Sure, absolutely.
Hyperthyroidism, infections,
right.
Inflammation. I'd like you to, I'm just going to outline these, and then I'd really like you to expand on them. Infections, inflammation of the prostate,
sure.
Genetic factors, or even ED.
Sure,
yeah.
ED, they can certainly impact that. I mean, diabetes, hypertension, there are a lot of underlying medical conditions which impact on, A, the ability to get an erection, and, B, the ability to ejaculate. So sometimes you come in for a routine prostate exam, we do a routine basic blood screening, and or just looking at a urine analysis, we see blood in the urine, we see signs of infection, we see signs of protein, which might indicate underlying kidney disease. So we can turn up all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. And it's really important. I like the mind-body approach to sexual dysfunction, because it takes both. It takes somebody dealing with the mind, and that might be me, although I think it's... You're so enlightened, it's you as well, that you do all of those things, as well as the body part. I have found that PE can affect the relationship greatly, that men are so focused on their own sexual performance and their worries about it that they neglect their partners. And I know you speak about this in your book as well.
Oh, I speak a lot about it. You know, it's not all about me. I think to have the most satisfying sexual experience, it's all about you, and almost me as an afterthought. I mean, that selflessness will pay off for greater mutual satisfaction. If you are concentrated, particularly, you know, in men, wham, bam, you know, thank you, ma'am. It may be great fun for you, but it doesn't predict or encourage a loving relationship. And we've often said, or I've said to you many times, Deanna, the greatest aphrodisiac, you know, is not rhinoceros horn or elephant tusk or goat gonads. It's love.
Yeah. It's so true, and I've discussed this with you on the program before, and I've met your lovely wife. How many years have you been married now?
Oh, my goodness, 46.
A lot. Yeah, 46?
Yeah.
So you have a great love relationship, so you know of which you speak.
And it feels like yesterday, and I just love it. When my wife, you know, I do something, you know, or And she'll say to me, just like out of the blue, do you still love me? You know, what? Wow. You know, it's just a great sort of feeling. Yeah, she's a lovely lady, and she has her own life and her own career, and just came back from overseas for a month of performing and doing her thing. And it's really, she's so enthusiastic. And I think that's so important in a relationship. I'm sure it goes both ways, but of course I speak mostly from a man's point of view, to allow, you know, the woman in your life the full breadth of her freedom and not be jealous or worried or concerned. And if you do that and allow them to express, you know, whatever talents they have, whether they be artistic or intellectual, the payout at the end of the day is going to be colossal.
Yes, and your wife has a beautiful voice, and she gets to sing. And who can be unhappy when they're singing, right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, just wake up in the morning, you hear a robin chirping outside of your window, and it's very invigorating. It makes you wake up with a smile on your face.
Sure. You know, in Chinese medicine, they talk about singing is important for the heart, for heart health.
Right.
And I can believe it.
I've heard laughing is excellent exercise for your liver. I don't know what that means, but...
Oh, really?
I must have a very healthy liver, because I certainly laugh a lot.
I have not heard that before, but I think laughing is such good medicine. That's been around for a long time. It's good medicine, and it's like internal jogging, because it increases respiration and hormones. And what else, doctor?
I think it's a psychological cleanser. You know, I think if you're worried and sad about everything in life and take everything in life seriously, I mean, I think it's a great advantage for somebody to step back and find laughter somewhere in a situation and optimism.
Yes.
I mean, it keeps your blood pressure down. It allays anxiety, and certainly if you're a urologist and doing what I do all day long, and if you can't laugh at this the male member of which about which so many men are focused on and obsessed with, you got to just step back and laugh at it. It will fail you sometimes. It will not perform the way you wish and hope it would on every occasion. It's not the end of the world. Take a step back, you know, take a deep breath and start all over again. I think there's a song that goes something like that.
That's right. I have a colleague and an acquaintance named William Granzig, and he is a sexologist, and he's also a graduate professor, a graduate school professor, and he'll sometimes say in his lectures, men are their cocks. And some of the females in the audience will look kind of perplexed. What? And he'll explain, well, it has to do with men being quite identified with their penises and if they work or not. And I'm sure that's your experience too for some of your patients.
I don't know if I invented the word, but I didn't see it anywhere else, and I talk about it a lot in my book. I say, you know, men are penocentric.
Oh yeah, you do say that, that's right.
So again, I don't know if I invented the phrase, but I hadn't heard it before I wrote about it, and it's very, very true. I mean, and disproportionately so when compared to women, and especially younger men. I mean, talk about the focus of their brains 24/7, that's about it. And I remember being an undergraduate at Princeton, and there was I guess it was Philosophy 101, and there was this hall filled, you know, with a few hundred freshmen or sophomore students, and the professor reminded everybody that if they could get their mind off that piece of meat, as he said, hanging between their legs, and put the energy that they put down there up between their ears, she said everybody would be Phi Beta Kappa and summa cum laude.
I love it. You've got a good education at Princeton.
Yeah, that was a good part of it. I do remember that. I mean, everybody rolled in the aisle. I mean, it was so true. All of it. All of these young guys with raging hormones. You know, all smart guys, and all they're doing is focused on their penises.
And it doesn't work.
Aristotle
too well. And but women, you know, I've worked with many couples where some of the women expressed fear that it reflected on them, whether it's premature ejaculation or erectile dysfunction, which we'll focus on a little more precisely as we go along. But they, you know, these women, they worry, a lot of these women, you know, that, oh, their guy no longer finds them attractive, or maybe they're having an affair. And then others report that they become dissatisfied with the frequency or the quality of their sex. And so then that means that sex becomes a stressor for both parties.
Right.
And as a result, some couples avoid the subject and the act entirely. And that is not good for their sex life.
Well, it certainly isn't. And I certainly think that, having said that, the solution to that problem comes under the category of communication. And I think, you know, the most important thing between a couple, I mean, basically on any level, whether you're talking about finances, rearing the children, you know, the color of the front door, is communication. And if something isn't working, you got to get it out on the table. You have to have a candid, straightforward discussion, the pluses and the minuses, and try to reach some consensus. So, yeah, there are those kinds of problems. You know, I talk about this in a book, but let me tell you a little bit about the nature of male and men. And I may have told you this story before, but I think it's
worth repeating for sure, Dr. D. For sure. Repeat it.
So the experiment goes like this. You put a male and a female mouse in a cage. The female is in heat. The male will mount the female repeatedly with longer periods of recovery, longer refractory periods, until the poor male mouse is lying exhausted with his tongue out on the floor of the cage. You take that lady mouse out. You paint her with a different mouse color, and you spray her with some new and different mouse perfume, and you put that same lady mouse back in the cage with the male mouse, and he starts all over again, almost the equivalent of square one. And not only is that an old experiment in the laboratory, but I think it says a lot about interpersonal relationships. As the relationship grows longer, and as we get used to one another, we begin to take each other for granted. And a lot of that fire begins to tarnish, begins to wane.
Yes.
And I think it takes a special effort. I mean, yeah, paint yourself a different color. I mean, both men and women. Spray a different perfume. Go to a different venue. Take a romantic vacation. Go out to a candlelight dinner. I mean, it does take an extra effort.
It absolutely does. And, you know, I talk about this a lot with my clients, my patients, because they're a lot of times they'll come in, well, we're bored, we need to spice up our relationship, and what do we do? Well, they do things that involve a little novelty, which creates a little bit more dopamine, the neurotransmitter dopamine, right? And then that will help.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's the I don't know if they measured the dopamine in the mouse, but but if they didn't, they should have.
Yes. I remember reading in, I think it was Masters and Johnson study, or maybe, no, it's probably something else, but it was wonderful that watching rats, so the male and the female rats, when sprinkled with cheese in front of the rats copulating, it was only the female rat that got distracted by the cheese. The male rat was just thrusting away, just having a great time. But right. he was not distracted by the cheese at all. So we do have female and male distinctions here.
Yeah, there's no question.
Yeah.
One of the physiologic facts is a man, everything shows, if a man doesn't have an erection firm enough to penetrate, he can't perform. A female can be more passive. She could be, you know, looking at the ceiling and admiring her hair or filing her nails. So for a man, there's a lot more pressure. And you know, every man wants to be a hero. Everybody wants to have a firm erection. Every man wants to catch that, ball in the fourth quarter of the last moment of the Super Bowl and score the touchdown. And it's very, very difficult for men to get over that machismo. And whether it be about problems of ED and coming to the doctor and saying, I'm having a problem, or going in for their annual prostate examination. I mean, a woman would never miss her pap smear yearly or a mammogram. Men, not the same. It's not the same animal.
Yeah. It isn't, and I'm glad you pointed that out. So before we focus a little bit more directly on erectile dysfunction, let's kind of finish up with some treatment possibilities for PE, for
so just to review a little bit about what we've already said, the simplest and most non-invasive are to try these exercises, which are well outlined in the book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. I describe them, and there's no need to go into detail on the radio. The second thing is to have more sex so that you increase the refractory period. The third thing with this over-the-counter promescent, which is basically a lidocaine spray, and then the last one is to do these SSRI anti-anxiety medications, which most commonly include Paxil and Zoloft. So those are the kind of four things in order of easiest to most severe.
And I also like to suggest that the guy might wear a condom, even if he doesn't need a condom.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And then the pause and
activity, surely.
Yeah, and then the pause and squeeze is very good, too.
Absolutely.
This is a form of behavioral training that can help men recognize feelings of impending ejaculation before it's too late to stop.
Yep.
And it doesn't seem to work for all men, but it's worth a try, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we call that the point of no return or inevitability. Remember that.
Right.
As I mentioned a moment ago, the actual ejaculatory function is a reflex. And once that level of excitation in a male is reached, there's no turning back, nothing he can do, or his partner.
Yeah, it's a reflex. The stop-start, or this was first mentioned by Masters and Johnson years ago in their research.
Right.
But the stop-start,
pause
for the man
squeeze,
to masturbate.
There's a lot of variations
on
that. The so-called Valsalva maneuver, bearing down to increase intra-abdominal pressure, that often helps. There are lots of maneuvers like that.
Yeah. So what about this? Just to go over it a little bit more. So during sex or even masturbation for the man, where he's on his own and paying attention, so I suggest that he stop stimulating the movements before he's ready to ejaculate.
Before the point of inevitability, yeah.
Exactly.
And certainly a man can practice that exercise on his own in the privacy of his own, you know, room. And it, and that is a very, very good exercise. And especially,
and
that is especially true of younger men.
Younger men, yes. Younger men. Because they have to get into some new habits.
Right.
Maybe they masturbated as teenagers and they feared discovery, so they would
hurry it up. Let's get it over with quickly.
Right.
Yeah,
And they get into bad habits.
Absolutely. No question about it. I think we're all guilty of that. I mean, all of us who will admit to it.
Uh-huh. Well, so you admit to that when you were a teenager?
Oh, yeah, my goodness. Are you kidding?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I would probably have had
more productive teenage years if I had paid less attention to that and more to some other things. I guess in the end it turned out all right.
Probably led you to urology.
Yeah, there you go. Well, how I got into urology is a completely different story, but here I am.
Oh, yeah, but share it. I'd love to hear how you got into it, other than enjoying your own pleasure.
An unusual specialty, you know, and people don't identify it. It's kind of a fringe specialty. Well, it started out when I was a medical student. You know, I was looking at medicine and surgery, and I said, well, I was whatever I got a better grade in, if I got a better grade in medicine, I'd be a medical doctor, and a surgical doctor, and I got an A in both. And then I said, well, I guess a surgeon can do everything a medical man can do, plus one thing, you know, he can actually cure disease. You know, it's hard to cure diabetes. It's hard to cure hypertension. You could treat them, but you certainly could fix a broken leg. You could take out a kidney tumor. You could take out a brain tumor. You could do an appendectomy. So that was very appealing. And in the early years of my training, I saw the live birth of a baby. This is before, you know, video and movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was the most miraculous thing I had ever witnessed. So I said, okay, now I want to be OBGYN and deliver babies. And we were living at that time on Long Island. It was the early days of automatic garage door openers that made a tremendous racket. And across the street from us was an OBGYN guy, and my father kept commenting, guy goes out at 2 o'clock in the morning, at 4 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. How could somebody live like that? And a month or two later, the guy has a massive heart attack in his 40s and dies. So,
oh, my goodness.
So I said, OBGYN is not for me. And then during my surgical training, I met a urologist from South Africa, one of our professors, who I thought was a very cool guy and doing very cool surgery. And I said, you know, I think I'd like to be like that guy when I grow up. And then what happens is you're lucky, because when you start out, you don't know what skill set it really takes to be a urologist. And, you know, whatever God gave me, eye-hand coordination, ambidexterity, exactly fit the needs of a urologic surgeon, and that was my good fortune. And that's the short version of a long story.
That's very interesting, Dr. Danoff. Among the surgeries that you do over a long career as a urologist, is prostate surgery the most common?
Yeah, by far in a way. The majority of my practice is dealing and treating prostate cancer, and I've watched the evolution of doing this surgery, which was used to be quite brutal, very difficult to preserve continence, very difficult to preserve potency, evolving into something which is elegant. It's done now. We use a Da Vinci robot, so we do it robotically. It's done without an incision. It's done as an outpatient. It's done with nearly perfect preservation of potency and preservation of continence. I mean, it is by far the most innovative thing in, you know, my 40 years practicing urology. So if a man does get prostate cancer and he is a candidate for surgery and he is a candidate for the Da Vinci robot, maybe it will take 3 or 4 weeks out of his life and then he'll forget he ever had it and he'll go on his merry way with essentially no changes.
We're digressing a little bit from, which I invited from our focus for this program on PE and ED, but I think it's very important because, and we have in the past discussed prostate cancer, and so many men did not have the right surgeon, and their potency and their continence, urinary, urinary incontinence came about, and that is just devastating for most men.
I mean, there's no question, as in anything, whether you go to an auto mechanic or go for fine dining, it's very it's very operator intensive. It's very surgeon dependent, and I think it's incumbent on anybody that's undergoing or contemplating undergoing a surgical procedure, you know, that they get the brightest and the best and go to centers that are, you know, doing these by the hundreds, if not the thousands, for the best results. But the technique is very, very elegant, and it's very refined, and it's very revolutionary.
And I'm going to guess that you, because I know you now some, and I'm going to guess that you liked learning this technique. That it was challenging, and then you liked the result.
Yeah. So, yeah. First of all, it's not like reinventing the world. First, we did it with an incision, and then we did it laparoscopically, and then we did hand-assisted laparoscopic, and then we went to the robot. So, all of these things developed incrementally. It wasn't like one day somebody, you know, woke and reinvented the wheel. So, but the change and the end game, the end result is really quite remarkable over how it was in the beginning. I mean, the beginning of my surgical career. So I'm basically, you know, a mainstream urologist that a couple of years ago had a silly idea to write a book about the penis and thought up the title Penis Power, you know, and you have the penis personalities. But I'm basically a mainstream oncologic urologic surgeon.
Yes,
just having a lot of fun with this.
You're having a lot of fun, and actually the humor is portrayed quite well in your book with all the kind of cartoons of the different penis personalities.
Yeah, it's the bedroom as he is in the boardroom. So we had some fun with that. There are positive personalities and negative personalities, and we had a lot of fun with that. But we don't take that too seriously.
No. In life, I mean, some people are so discouraged and depressed that they do take stuff seriously. But it really helps if you can bring in some humor.
Without a doubt. I think, you know, especially in any intimate relationship, you know, there are going to be faux pas and flops and failures. And if you can't step back and laugh at yourself, don't laugh at your partner. Yeah. You know, don't laugh at yourself.
Yes, and don't take yourself too seriously.
Absolutely not. And I am a proponent of that philosophy.
Yes. So before we get into a little more focused on erectile dysfunction, I wanted to mention another thing about PE. And that is partner sex. And I suggest that that the guy, after his penis enters her vagina, that he focus on his level of arousal. And when he's at the point of no return, to stop moving and just breathe deeply until the urge subsides, you know, Master deep breathing. It's really hard to feel anxious when you're right. breathing deeply. And so this is, I really like the idea of being mindful in the moment and breathing deeply. And you know, when the man can trust his lover to breathe deeply and show her how much she turns him on, then it's likely to turn her on as well, all that mutual breathing.
No, no, there's no question about it. And I would add, mm-hmm. you know, to use that the medical term is a Valsalva maneuver, but it's basically like holding your breath and bearing down and increasing intra-abdominal pressure. So while you're pausing and not moving, you try that Valsalva maneuver, and that also de-enervates the area. So that's also a very valuable maneuver.
Okay, so talk about that a little bit, Dr. D. The Valsalva, I mean, you have before, but we need to review it again. But the Valsalva
Yeah, well,
maneuver,
it just means if you take a deep breath and you kind of bear down, you know, as if you pardon the expression, as if you're having a bowel movement, but obviously
yeah.
you don't have a bowel movement. But that's the sense, and it increases intra-abdominal pressure, and it puts pressure on the veins, and it de-enervates the area of the pelvis. So it's a valuable adjunct. It sometimes helps, but it's important to stop stimulation prior to the moment of inevitability, because once you've gone over that, there's no turning back. So the trick is either with masturbation or exercises with your partner is to take yourself over and over to almost to the point of inevitability, and to recognize that in your own mind's eye and stop, and then try to start again from square one.
Very good advice. What do you think, Dr. Danoff, about slow insertion? I sometimes suggest this to my clients, that it's important because the most sensitive, nerve-rich part of the penis is the head. And when
Absolutely.
You push into a vagina quickly, the head might become overstimulating.
Absolutely.
Overstimulated.
You know, all
which triggers ejaculation. Yeah.
Sure. All the action is right up front, you know. So, you know, we sometimes mm-hmm. are obsessed with size, and, you know, size is a matter of preference. But at the end of the day, all the action is right at the tip. It's at the tip of the penis called the glans, G-L-A-N-S. And the most
yeah.
sensitive part of the female is the clitoris. So, I mean, there are other
mm-hmm.
sensory areas, but those by far are the most sensitive.
I instruct my clients, the male clients, to get used to what it feels like, then to slowly insert the head and get used to that, and don't plunge into intercourse.
Yeah.
A lot of guys want to plunge into it, and it doesn't work for them, especially if they've got some PE issues, right?
Right. We should touch a little bit, you know, in terms of the pills that are available. There's a whole pharmacology of ED,
yeah.
and, you know, people always ask for that, and it's a billion-dollar industry, pharmaceutical industry, and it's
yeah.
certainly extended the erectile function of men to an older generation, and has, you know, brought new life to men that formerly, for reasons of age or illness, were unable to get an erection firm enough for penetration. And the most common drug is Viagra. And then we have Cialis, mm-hmm. you know, with the tagline, if your erection lasts more than 4 hours, call your doctor. I personally would call everybody I knew if that happened to me, but... And then there's Levitra. So these drugs they're called PDE5 inhibitors. They're basically
yeah.
vasodilators, meaning they increase blood flow. They are not
mm-hmm.
of desire. They do not increase your desire. They're pills of performance. And when used judiciously,
mm-hmm.
they are fantastic drugs.
Yes, they are. Now, occasionally, Like, I have a client who has end-stage kidney disease and diabetes, and none of those PDE5 inhibitors work for him.
Right.
And that's maybe not surprising. But for
most men who are healthy,
it's... Yeah.
I mean, there are other things on the shopping list to increase blood flow. The simplest, obviously, is the oral drugs, and they are the most widely used. But for your patient who has end-stage mm-hmm. renal disease and diabetes, it means he has peripheral nerve damage, he may need something called an injectable. And the injectable that we use is a chemical called prostaglandin E1 and sometimes abbreviated PGE1. And it's given with a tuberculin syringe and a tiny little needle, and you actually inject the substance about 15 minutes before you want to have sex into the base of the penis, not at the tip. I mean, men are just shuddering as they're listening to this. What, stick a needle in where? But stick this little tiny needle in at the base, and it's a very, very powerful drug and works in almost everybody. So there are other things other than the oral agents.
Yes, and don't you find that most guys, once in your office and you demonstrate the injectable, and they it's a very tiny needle, and then you show them how to do it themselves, that most guys will get over the fear because the trade-off is there. Then they have an erection strong enough for penetration, and they can have some more fun with
intercourse. There's no question. Once they get over that initial fear, they just love it. They just love
it. Yeah. But and then don't you? Well, of course they experience it, but that the needle is such a fine gauge needle that it's not like getting a shot of for the flu or something.
No, nothing like that.
Yeah. So all of these can be really, really helpful. And so let's also talk about, I suggest for guys with ED. That there are also some supplements like L-arginine. It's an amino acid. I don't know if you get into this area very much, but most men don't get enough of it in their diet, so I recommend an L-arginine supplement. This may be sort of out of your medical area. But there
as a mainstream physician, there are some herbal medicines and vitamins and things like that, which I always approach is by saying it's a little bit like a chicken soup. It wouldn't hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Very few double-blind studies, crossover really scientific studies have been done with salt palmetto, arginine, a lot of things like
horny
that.
Horny goat weed. I love the title.
but remember, Deanna, and I think we've touched on in previous programs on this, something called the placebo effect.
So if you take any
medicine, let's say you take a medicine for headaches, and you have mm-hmm. the sugar pill, and then you have the one that cures headaches, and you give it two matched groups, and then you cross them over, about 40% of the people who get the sugar pill will say, oh, yeah, that made my headache, better. That's called a placebo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you take a medicine and attach it to sexuality, a better erection, more satisfying sex, a greater orgasm, well, then you get that 40% placebo effect, and you multiply it because sex is so a matter of between the ears. I often say 99% between the ears and 1% between the legs. So the power of suggestion is overwhelming. And, if you're going to pay $60 for a pile of pills that is supposed to, make your penis bigger and make your orgasms more explosive, you and your mind's eye are going to think, that's really happening. So the placebo effect is even more magnified when it comes to sex.
Absolutely, and that's why for years people have said the most important sex organ is the brain, that which lies between your ears.
Absolutely. Now, look, there are certainly some exceptions. I mean, if you have some underlying medical condition, so if the brain factor becomes less. I mean, if you have uncontrolled hypertension or diabetes or hypercholesterolemia or peripheral vascular disease or some neurologic condition, you know, then it becomes, you know, more organ-focused. But the majority of patients who suffer from ED don't have any of that.
They don't. That's right. They just have a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
As they do with PE.
Yeah.
So I sometimes get my patients to visualize for sex success, and that involves, we're back to breathing, lying on their back on a mat or a rug with their arms at their sides, and take a deep breath and hold it for a moment, then exhale, lie still, and continue breathing slowly. And then once relaxed, picture yourself about to have sex and go through the step-by-step sequence of events. And then imagine every aspect of the session, including the sights and sounds and smells associated with sex, and try to rehearse the action in your mind just as you would actually perform. And so it becomes mental practice. And when the time comes for the actual moment, the man's confidence is apt to be higher. So this visualizing can be powerful.
No, and I think it is a very powerful tool. I mean, as a urologist, obviously, you know, I'm not so much into that end of it. I'm more physiologic and anatomic, but I think that you make an excellent point. And I think, you know, in terms of serious ED problems, the urologist must work hand in hand with the sex therapist, because I think one enhances the other. I mean, it's important, for example, for the sex therapist to be assured that there's no underlying organic problem. And, you know, I mean, you can have an organic problem and a psychological problem, but in order to properly treat it, you got to first treat the organic problem. So I think the hand-in-hand symbiosis of the sex therapist and the urologist is very important.
In Los Angeles, do you have some sex therapists that you like to refer to?
You know, I would prefer not. I actually refer to quite a few of them. You know, and they're very kind, and they refer lots of patients to me. So I don't want to single anyone out. But yeah, they are available, and we have some very responsible people, you know, who we think do a very credible job.
Right.
I think there are some marginal people out there. I think just as I think there's some marginal urologists out there that, you know, are selling the sugar pill. But by and large, there are a lot of reputable people around, and most of our patients who suffer from ED are well-treated and do improve.
Yes. Well, I have a relationship with a couple of urologists, and I've had some nice successes with helping
I think that echoes the reaction to most of us in this business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't you love the business? And that's probably why you're still in it and not retired, huh?
Well, I'm having fun doing it. I still have a lot of skill. I think I still have my marbles. I have the benefit
of
wisdom. So I have 12 younger partners. I let them do a lot of the heavy lifting, but I'm always encouraged to be involved in the operating room when they come to me for advice. How should we do this? What do you think of that? How should we treat that? So for me, it's very, very gratifying. I try to take, you know, time off and enjoy my success, but at the same time, I would be disappointed if I weren't doing what I have done for the last 40-plus years.
I understand what you're saying, and I'm very grateful that I first heard you. Well, it was actually, I knew about you before this, but I heard you lecture at an ASECT conference in Monterey back in 2012, I think it was.
Yeah.
And ASECT is American Association for Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. And so impressed, and then I started inviting you on this program. I'm so grateful that you have returned again and again.
Well, I always enjoy talking to you. I mean, I do lots and lots of radio interviews and TV stuff, but when I get somebody who asks the right questions and the provocative questions and allows me to kind of entertain and educate the listeners, you know, that makes me good, and that's why I keep coming back.
Oh, good. Good. Well, I love having you here, and I was thinking about how people need to remember, and this is absolutely tied in with our conversation today, that sex is not all about the penis. And the myth is probably an outgrowth of pornography, which is totally penis-focused or penile-centric, as you talk about it, because actually great sex involves your whole body. It's based on leisurely, playful, whole-body sensuality for both the man and the woman.
Yeah, it's the greatest
exercise. Would you not agree? Yes.
Your vascular fitness, upper body strength, lower body strength. And if you want to have good sex, you better be in good shape. I'm not saying if you're not in peak physical condition that you can't have good sex, but you are limited. Mm-hmm. And the same goes true for aging. You know, you have to be a little bit more careful about positioning and balance. But it's no less satisfying.
I think about it as having a robust sexual life, even as a senior, it's like the fountain of youth.
Oh, you betcha.
And that's why you look so good and your wife looks so good. And there's the music. Well, I'll speak to you off the air, Dr. Danoff, but sure would like to get you back again in a few months. Okay?
Ah, absolutely. Go to the Ultimate Guide to Male.
And I'll write that up in the review. Thanks again, Dr. D. Bye-bye, everybody.